I'm Bert Cohen, and with your help, we are keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse. Stand clear. Push to shock.
America's fascists are those people who think Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
What we've really seen is a financial sector that's gotten out of hand, has much too much of a role in this country.
What Putin is trying to do and what Trump is trying to do is undermine faith in our government.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans.
There's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy that people don't feel that they can do very much.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
The great American poet Robert Frost, who spoke at JFK's inauguration, wrote, "Before I built a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out, and to whom I was like to give offense. Something there is that doesn't love a wall." In 1937, Jean Renoir's masterpiece film was called The Grand Illusion. It ends with two fugitives fleeing the horrors of World War I. A German patrol sights the two fugitives crossing a snow-covered valley. The soldiers fire a few rounds, but then the patrol leader orders them to cease fire, saying the pair have crossed into Switzerland. That border was the Grand Illusion. The classic movie of that title is based on a British book, The Great Illusion, by British journalist Norman Angell, which argues that war is futile because of the common economic interests of all European nations. And indeed, during that insane and pointless war, there were many mutinies. The young working men of all sides realized they were all brothers and had no reason to kill each other. Dead set against this ever-elusive unity among humanity are those like President Trump, who does love a wall. At the core of his support is a demand to keep out the others. So there is something that does love a wall, a physical barrier to make sure those desperate and poor people, specifically of color, wanting what every human wants, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, will never be able to penetrate the separation from our imagined white, Christian, male-dominated, gated community. What are borders for, really? Many Americans have their own property, sometimes with fences and borders. We like to feel safe from unwanted intruders. So it seems logical for nations to do the same. But is it somehow different for what we recognize as a commonwealth, a land all of us share? With us today to discuss her thought-provoking article in Truth Out titled, "We Can't Obtain Immigration Justice in a World of Borders and Nations," is its author, Rebecca Centeno, an activist, media maker, and journalist covering border immigration issues. Her reporting has been featured in Truth Out, The Washington Post, Now This Politics, and ACT TV. Thanks so much for being with us, Rebecca Centeno.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, the purpose of your article seems clear from your opening statement. We can't reckon with the extreme inequalities and inherent injustices of immigration policy without an analysis of how borders, the state, and capitalism function to create them, end of quote. There's a lot packed into that statement. So let's try to unpack it a little bit. What are examples of the extreme inequalities and inherent injustices of immigration policy?
So I really appreciated your introduction about the illusion and also references to war and who benefits, because I think it speaks to power and who benefits economically, right? A person like Trump. So about the extreme inequality, so we all understand, it's widely accepted that there's wealth inequality that exists within nations, within the United States. Lower income people struggle with things like food insecurity, housing insecurity, their life expectancy is often shorter as a result. And so these inequalities within nations are undeniable. We talk about them all the time. What we don't talk about is that when we look at inequality in the United States, it actually pales in comparison to the wealth inequality on a global scale. And so the person who, Nandita Sharma, who's quoted in the article, she turned me on to an economist named Branko Milanovic, who is the former lead economist at the World Bank, of all places, and he studies global inequality. And so there was a Forbes article published even just a couple of years ago, and it said that the typical person in the bottom 5% of the American income distribution is still richer than around 70% of all people in the world, 68% of the world's inhabitants. Which is like hard. I mean, it's wild, the level of extreme inequality. And so just, you know, where a person was born, which is something that nobody can control, is one of the greatest indicators of how their life will be. It's unjust because, so the second part of the inherent injustices. So I actually, I met Nandita Sharma at an Open Borders conference in New York City, and she was on a panel, and one of the first things she said that really struck me, and I've been covering border immigration for the past year, but I'm from Texas, and I've seen, you know, the increased militarization and the vile, you know, rhetoric from people like Trump and his base just really take off. And it's been difficult because I oftentimes feel we don't get to the core of the issue. One of the first things Nandita Sharma said was that immigration policy is not designed to be just or fair. It never will be. It's by design meant to exclude people. So all immigration policy restricts mobility. That's the purpose. That's what it's designed to do. Even though people have been moving and migrating across the globe since forever. So what happens is that people, you know, for whatever reason need to move, whether their country is at war, maybe their family members have been killed or threatened, maybe they're being persecuted for being LGBTQ, their mobility is being restricted. And so when you have a policy that is by design meant to exclude people, to restrict people's mobility, even if their life is at risk, it puts people in danger, and it quite literally tells somebody that, you know, we decide whether or not somebody can move, whether or not somebody can live.
Yes.
And
deciding if somebody can live, really, I don't think a lot of people think about that. You've quoted Nandita Sharma a couple times. Who is she?
So she is a sociologist and a doctor, and she teaches at the University of Manoa in Hawaii, and she's also an activist in No Borders movements. She's a feminist and an anti-capitalist, so she speaks out against capitalism, and she's very much pro-No Borders. And she's written a lot about it. She's amazing, and, like, just, you know, talking to her and doing research even led me to reflect on and to realize, like, some of my beliefs that are so entrenched on nationalism. And I often would refer to myself as Mexican American, like, I'm Mexican American, and even that I've stopped using after and just in doing research and learning more about nationalism.
Yeah, nationalism.
So it forced me to do a lot of self-reflection on my ideas that were so deep I didn't even realize.
Well, introspection is, I find, always instructive. So many people are scared to do that. And, you know, one of the things about Marianne Williamson, who was running for president, one of the great things she talked about was how we as a nation need to do a thorough analysis of who we are really and what we've done. And most of the time, we don't want to do that. I mean, it's tough as a, you know, an individual, so as a nation, but it's really important to do that. And to look into how borders, the state and capitalism function to create the injustices calls for a look at many factors. We in our homes, for example, the question of borders and property lines, we in our homes expect to be safe from intruders. It seems like a right, really. I definitely feel that. That reality assumes, however, that there is economic inequality. But given there will never be total economic equality and that people work to get stuff and don't want that stuff stolen, being safe in our homes is a very high, fair, and reasonable priority, I think. But this does not explain all property violations. Homes are sometimes broken into by police, usually with warrants, but not always. These homes are usually not in high-income areas. Perhaps there's a qualitative difference between personal property and the borders around our nation. I mean, we like to feel safe in our personal property. Tell us some of your reactions, please, to any qualitative difference between personal property and the borders around our nation.
Definitely, and it does speak to economic inequality, I believe. So it also speaks to nationalism and this ideology that the people of a nation or a state own the land. They believe it's theirs, it's their home. And so for people in the United States or the UK or rich and powerful nations, it's easy for us to think that everybody wants to come here because we're so exceptional, we're so great. And there is an element of that when we are, you know, the people who are more wealthy and powerful and exploit other nations. But I also think, so there's something that I spoke to Roberto Lovato about in the article about push and pull factors. And so I think this analogy forgets the push factors, which is that many people don't want to leave their homes. They're
right,
actually fleeing their lives, you know, risking their lives and fleeing to get here. They're putting themselves in extreme danger. Sometimes they go into debt, and so they're actually being pushed out. And I think that this analogy forgets that. But I also do think it speaks to ownership and sharing the land. And I think of, you know, I think of the Native Americans who were here. I made a documentary, and so I did a lot of research about the nations, and not to, you know, romanticize it, and yes, they were tribal, and they did kill each other and steal each other's, you know, horses and things like that, but I think the idea of, like, a border or a wall would have just been, like, unheard of, right?
And I'm reminded of good old Woody Guthrie's song, "This Land Is Your Land, This Land Was Made for You and Me." And there's a stanza in there that's usually cut out. And I don't remember it exactly, but how he crossed some wall. And on one side it said no trespassing, but the other, it didn't say anything on the other side. That land was made for you and me. I love that.
Exactly. Exactly.
Good old Woody Guthrie. It'd be nice to have that as our national anthem, wouldn't it? If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest is Rebecca Centeno, and we're talking about an article she wrote, "We Can't Obtain Immigration Justice in a World of Borders and Nations." You were about to say, sorry I interrupted.
No, just speaking about Woody Guthrie, he also wrote on his guitar, "This Machine Kills Fascists."
Yeah.
So he said, yeah.
Yeah, we like Woody Guthrie, and we don't fascists, and we don't like racists, et cetera, et cetera. We certainly are on the same side, shall we say, thinking of borders. Trump's border wall fixation has upset a lot of people, even conservatives, with its just kind of surprising harshness. It doesn't seem to be, you know, within the American self-identity, you know, putting young children in cages, separating families, setting up concentration camps. These offend traditional American sensibilities. And as you point out, current liberal immigration news is often centered on reducing current harm. What would that be? And why does, what do they mean by harm reduction? Why does it need to be moved beyond harm reduction?
So I think a couple of things. I think that it's true, it offends traditional sensibilities, and I think that Trump's overt harshness really upset a lot of people, as it should. The country was also founded, as we know, on the genocide of Native Americans and enslavement of African Americans. And over the years, there were many immigrants who were demonized when they were coming here and seeking refuge, from Jewish people to Italians to Irish people. And so on the one hand, it's offensive, but it's not new. And I think with harm reduction, if we think of it as like a wound that is gushing blood, and I mean, it is very real, I think, and visceral for me and for people who have witnessed, you know, just the pain and like the utter desperation, and the real lives that are at risk. So when you talk about harm reduction, it's important, right? It's almost like a tourniquet, but it doesn't get to the heart of the issue. It doesn't stop the bleeding. And so all of the, you know, there are a lot of efforts that people are doing, from, you know, water drops, for example, like the group No More Deaths in Arizona, where people are dying in the desert, and so they're leaving water for them. But also, like, not even just on the border, people are doing work around detention centers and raids, you know, everywhere from Philadelphia to New York to California, even Mississippi. I feel like there's a lot of solidarity work that's happening to help immigrants who are suffering. And I think that work is crucial to prevent more unnecessary suffering and death. It's so important, but it doesn't get to the heart of the issue.
Interesting, and we need to talk about that. You know, as you said, it takes a lot for anyone to get up and leave their home. I mean, think about, you know, who wants to do that? It's the last thing you want to do. And let's assume that, at least for the sake of discussion, that, okay, we need to stop any flood of refugees. But building a wall obviously doesn't work. It's like a drug war. As long as there's a demand, there's going to be a supply. And that's, I think, what we need to get to. Why is there the demand? Wars, great poverty, police repression, for some reasons, in terms of actually slowing what may be, I don't know, it gets exaggerated, a river of refugees. What, if anything, has the U.S. government done to address the demand, the reasons people flee, and what could be done to address that and to get to really the core of why people come?
So, I think the first answer to, I agree, it is like the drug war, and about demand, supply and demand. I think it's capitalism. I think it all boils down to capitalism, and all the research that I've done and talking to people and having, you know, an analysis, a class analysis, and in some ways, and I know this sounds cynical, but the U.S. is profiting off of people fleeing, and is actually profiting off of this system, because people in other countries are being exploited, and their labor is being exploited, their resources are being exploited, and so it benefits the ruling class here. When they try to come here, it still benefits the ruling class, because they're put into private detention centers. There's a whole industry, just like the drug industry, right? Just like the drug, and like there's a whole industry that is profiting off of people who are trying to come here. So the reasons people flee, people are desperate. I've talked to immigrants and asylum seekers who say the same thing, which is what we were talking about, is that people don't want to leave. Yeah. And they say things like, stop messing with our countries. You know, we had a president who we voted for democratically, and that president was overthrown. I mean, the U.S. has participated in like military coups in Latin America for decades. We've interfered in their economic systems because we wanted to profit off of, you know, things like oil, for example, in Venezuela. And I think, you know, I do think that there are politicians who can help, and who are putting forth very progressive platforms. And a lot of people who are activists, and even cynical, and people, you know, immigration rights activists, are rallying behind Bernie Sanders, who I believe would push the country in a good direction, and may not be able to solve all of the deeper issues, right? Because the United States would still exist as a nation state. It would still have borders. Uh-huh. It would still be a capitalist nation. But Bernie Sanders really challenges a lot of the ideas that I think people just, I don't know, take for granted. I think he can help us go a little left. I really do. And expand our political horizons and some of the things that we really are trying to achieve.
And we have to look at, as you say, you know, why people flee. Trump has talked about cutting off aid to certain countries. That is going to have the opposite effect of slowing down people fleeing. You know, you get a more repressive government, you get more austerity measures put in by, you know, the World Bank and things like that. That's going to only encourage people to flee. I'm sure this was an imperfect program, but under John Kennedy, there was the Alliance for Progress, which, you know, it seemed to go around, you know, the juntas and the the oil barons and the banana companies, etc., that love to go down there and pay people, you know, pennies on the dollar for hard work. But if we can, perhaps, maybe this is dreaming, show respect for people and, you know, have decent wages there, and require our companies to have environmental regulations and decent labor laws, then there'd be less demand to come here, I would think. And you're right, Bernie Sanders, I don't know if any of the others are talking about that, but, you know, most people don't talk about this. They see the hype, you know, these other people coming here, you know, we got to build a wall, we got to keep them out here. Obviously, it's you know, based on racism. I mean, there's just no question about that. Because, I mean, Trump even said, you know, if Nordic people wanted to come here, oh, yeah, they'd be welcome. But, I wonder about how necessary it is to try to keep people out. I mean, I am not a Native American by background, not at all. My ancestors came here in the late 1800s, and I don't think there was the same kind of, you know, border madness at that time. I mean, later on, as we'll discuss, there have been purges against hyphenated Americans, as it was called. But it's generally assumed that America never had open borders, did we? When and why did that change? Did we have open borders, really?
We absolutely did. And I know, I think this is something that many of us don't know. I certainly didn't even know. I didn't know this. But for the first 100 years after the Declaration of Independence was signed, so that was signed in 1776, for the first 100 years after that, we had open borders. The first restrictive immigration policy was signed in 1875, and that was the Page Act, which banned Chinese quote-unquote coolies, which is a derogatory term. It's essentially an indentured laborer, and it also banned women brought for, quote, lewd and immoral purposes. And so you mentioned racism, and racism functions to create these divisions, so people imagine themselves to be different, right? Like, I'm a different race than you. You're black, I'm white, you're brown, I'm white. Yeah, like all of these ways to divide the working class. And so all of these immigration policies and border policies are racist. And racism is used to divide the working class.
Absolutely. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. There's no question.
No, it's
go ahead.
So much.
Yeah.
No, there's so much. So, like, you know, it's a tool, right? Racism is a tool that the working class can use to divide people and to say, like, okay, if the working class is upset or they feel threatened for their jobs, or, you know, and Trump does this all the time, and he's not the first one to do it, but he does it. And it's saying, oh, we're not the problem, right? Like the CEOs and the bosses and the ruling class and like the wealthy, we're not the problem. It's these people, right? These foreigners,
right?
These
those others,
black people, these brown people. Yeah, these other people.
The others. Ah, yes. It's so nice to have the others. We're okay, but it's those others. I mean, it's laughable, but it does a lot of damage. A lot of people, good people, get hurt by thinking of things that way. You see it, I see it. And as you mentioned, there's a lot of concern about solidarity among the working class. That picture frightens the ruling class more than anything. In the early 20th century, the IWW, International Workers of the World, also known as Wobblies, scared the bejesus out of the owners of the means of production. It was one big union, welcoming all. I mean, most unions were, excluded people of color and from other countries. Yeah. But the IWW welcomed all, men and women of all colors and all nationalities. Then came what was called, at the time, the Great War, World War I. It pitted, in these trenches, these horrible trenches, workers from one country against workers from another country, again, with the grand illusion of these borders. After years of unspeakable horror and stalemate, the war just going on and on and on, and the industrialists making tremendous profits, many workers among the various enemy sides started to recognize, hey, I got nothing against the people I'm supposed to kill. Germans, French, everybody. Of course, the mutinies were put down, often brutally, as one can imagine. But you just can't have international worker solidarity. You quote Professor Sharma on this. I wonder if you could share that with us.
Sure. So I think we are all workers, essentially, and that we often talk about like economic policy as if it's separate from everything else, but I believe that it's all together, right? Like we're all in this together. We all exist to cultivate food and to work and to make our lives just a better place for all of us. That can't happen with obviously borders and the creation of hierarchies serves the ruling class. So borders and these differentiations of like race and nationality fractures international worker solidarity, but also solidarity within nations. And we can see that happening now in a real clear way with Trump. So for example, poor white people see themselves, they can identify themselves with like rich white people more so than they can identify themselves with like poor people in other countries, right?
Yes.
Or like those Chinese quote unquote coolies, or the brown person. So racism functions to fracture worker solidarity, and so do borders. And so whiteness, like this idea of whiteness, which is a creation.
Absolutely.
Yeah, functions to fracture solidarity among workers.
Yeah, the ruling class has been against that for a long, long time. And speaking of lions and the First World War, which, yeah, okay, I focus on quite a bit. France and England drew lines literally in the sand. Borders, they created borders in the former Ottoman Empire in the Middle East. And they created, for example, Iraq. They drew these lines in the sand that just a few years ago, the ISIS group proudly went through, they bulldozed through the Sykes-Picot line, a line that was drawn in their territory without their knowledge or their approving it. The point is these borders are an illusion and they're, slapped down on pieces of earth, but it's not real. I mean, people still, I think they do have an innate need for a sense of belonging to a tribe, which is very different from a top-down imposed border. And I think what you were saying about, you know, poor whites identify with rich whites rather than people of the same economic class looks to that as well. What about this? I just have a feeling that there's some sort of innate need for tribes. We started to feel that, some of us did in the late 60s, the old hippie stuff, like, you know, we're together here. We all had long hair and different stuff. And there is some sort of need for tribes. But how does that compare or contrast with, you know, a desire for a border, a solid border? What about, you know, recognizing some sense of needing to belong?
I agree. I think, you know, people need to belong, people need to feel loved, and I think that a lot of the resistance to abolishing borders and abolishing nation states comes from that place of people enjoying, you know, certain traditions, customs, food, you know, feeling like they belong. And so my response has been that those things, right, and that belonging and those customs, those traditions existed before the state. They can exist uh-huh. after the state. In other words, even you know, borders, as you said, like, borders don't create those things. People create those things. Borders have shifted. They have been so arbitrary, right?
Yes.
Just as like a line drawn in the sand.
Yes.
And so this perception that like people are different on one side of the line drawn in the sand versus another line, you know, versus on the opposite side of the sand, it's just not true. It's an illusion. So those things, belonging, those cultures, those traditions, they can exist without borders and without states. An example I'll say, so my family has been in Texas for generations, and so many times people ask me, where are you from? And I say, I'm originally from Texas, and they say, what's your background? And I'll just say Mexican because I look, you know, visibly different. And then they say, well, where in Mexico from? And then I'll say, well, Texas was Mexico.
Right.
And, you know, and so exactly, borders cross people. And, you know, I don't think borders and states give us that identity. We think it does, but they don't actually.
It's true, and it's like imposed from the top down. Like, I don't think, you know, the drawers of borders and states realize this, but, you know, it's like they're playing on an innate need that people have to feel a sense of belonging, and they're saying, oh, this is how you do it. This is how we're going to draw the lines. And I think about, you know, the various tribes that there have been. I mean, nation states are actually just relatively recent. I mean, Germany only came to existence, and Italy too, in the late 19th century. They were smaller tribes, if you will, that they, you know, somehow, and it's an arbitrary border. There are arbitrary borders all over the place. And, you know, this illusion that this is a legitimate, you're on one side, the other's on the other side, it's two different things. It's not true. It's absolutely not true. You're right. Mexico, I mean, Texas was part of Mexico, and we stole it, and it was, you know, horrible, and but the powers that be wanted it. For those who may have just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive, and we're talking with Rebecca Centeno about her article, We Can't Obtain Immigration Justice in a World of Borders and Nations. We're talking about borders and nations and racism. And one of the reasons Brexit became law was because of this issue of immigration. You know, there's that island, currently United Kingdom. I don't think it's going to stay united all that long. Actually, I think they probably are going to break up into tribes that used to be there. But it's certainly one of the reasons for Brexit appears to be racist, that they wanted to keep the others out. And yeah, it's got some degree of racism, no question about it. It seems to me that the price for being an empire like Britain used to have is that people subjugated, of course, seek to come to the country that's in control of them. Empires inevitably implode. They collapse on themselves. I think there's a lot to that there. I wonder if you could comment on that, please.
So it was really sad to see Jeremy Corbyn lose.
Yes, it was.
I had high hopes.
I stood on.
And I do. I think racism had a lot to do with it. And I think, you know, they even attacked Jeremy Corbyn, saying, you know, he is an anti-Semite. They even tried that with Bernie Sanders, who's Jewish.
Right.
So, yeah. But I think, yes, I think people do want to come to the country, like you said, in control. I think people want a piece of the pie. I think it's natural and even justified that people would want to enjoy a little bit more economic benefit, especially since their labor has been helping that country. And I met with people from the migrant caravan. Many of them were asylum seekers, and so it's probably apropos to say refugee caravan.
Sure.
Because I feel like migrant kind of minimizes it. And me and a group of friends went to Mexico City while they were there, and we met with people, and people would say, we just want a better life. And for us in the U.S., I think a lot of people don't really fully understand, right? We think like, oh, okay, you know, they want a little bit more, right? Like maybe they're making a few dollars an hour and they want a little more dollars, but that's not what they mean. It means that like we would talk to them more and get a little bit more in depth, and they would say things like, well, yeah, my uncle was killed, my brother was killed, my mother was killed when I was young, there's no work. And so this speaks to the great inequalities that we were talking about earlier, global inequalities. And so I think it's deeper about empires imploding. So, you know, Nandita Sharma is a sociologist. I'm not an expert in sociology by any means, but I've talked with her and I've heard her speak. And so she talks about the existence of nations and how old they are, and how they're fairly new, and they change, right? Like what kind of states, whether they're imperial states or nation states, and so I think it's possible. Like I don't know, I'm not a sociologist, but from the research I've done and just knowing about history, I agree that they will eventually implode. But what comes next is what I'm thinking about also.
Oh yeah, there will be, and you know, people try hard to organize and divide the world by nationalism. I mean, the rise of nationalism is not inconsistent with what we're talking about here, that the people want to feel like my country's better than yours, you others have to stay out of my country. And these are people who are, you know, dead set against any kind of internationalism. You know, that's some kind of communist conspiracy or something like that. I mean, the people who it used to be just the far right who was, you know, against the United Nations, but now, you know, it seems to be the dominant, you know, tack of the Republican Party. And, you know, to be against other countries and to divide, you know, arbitrarily, it does support the capitalist ruling class agenda of keeping people divided so that the current system of, you know, trickle up can keep on working and keep separating people. It works really, really well for the top few percent. And I was amazed, I must say, the number that you gave at the beginning of the show, that what, like 68% of the people on the earth live worse off than the lowest 5% of Americans.
They live better. They live better. No, sorry, worse off.
Yeah.
Worse off. That our, yes.
It's correct. It's appalling. People don't realize that now. But, and the you know, dividing people amongst themselves is a brilliant strategy. I think there was that film with the Richard Pryor, Blue Collar, where dividing people by race, you know, wouldn't it be nice if working people could stand together? And, you know, Bernie is touching on that quite a bit, and I think it's working really, really well. I think he would have won last time, but that's another story. And
me too.
I can't let World War I go. One of the effects of that was that President Wilson, Woodrow Wilson, during the war to gin up support, nationalist support against those, the Huns, the others, the dangerous people there, you know, painting. There was a poster of a brute, like an ape-like figure that was Germany. You may have seen that poster, recruiting thing. But he vilified, President Wilson vilified what they called hyphenated Americans. They weren't real Americans. They weren't 100% American. These were recent immigrants to the United States, of which there were a lot, were not white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. And his attorney general, A. Mitchell Palmer, boo hiss, conducted raids on these Americans who were pictured as suspect, not 100% American. Many were arrested and lost their jobs and even deported. It's all part of the same mindset of borders, I think. You know, hyphenated Americans, they're not us, they're the other. Is this part of the same mindset, do you think, that we're talking about?
Absolutely. And I admit I haven't done my research on, World War One, but from
a surprise.
Absolutely. yes, and like I think about this, you know, and even just talking about whiteness, we like now, you know, Italian Americans are considered quote unquote white, but when they were migrating here.
Sure.
Or Jews, like it's astonishing to me that people, just going back to Bernie Sanders, they're like, he's a white man, he's a white man.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, he's Jewish.
Right.
If we were living in another part of history, I don't think that they would say, oh, he's this, right, you know, privileged white man. So it speaks to memory. It speaks of tools, right, that people use. Like for President Wilson to vilify what he would call hyphenated Americans, I would say, like, well, where is your family from? Right? And like, were they vilified? And why are you vilifying new immigrants?
And my dad used to talk about, when he was a kid, he was born in 1914. When he was a kid, there were signs up in Boston that said, Irish need not apply. They were not considered mm-hmm. white. You know, that's the the other as well, setting people against each other. Oh, it's a wonderful thing to do, isn't it? And, you know, you mentioned Roberto Lovato, a writer and journalist who has reported on Central American refugees issues for almost 30 years. He said that the border is, quote, an illusion, a deadly, murderous, memory-destroying thing, end of quote. To create a border, states have to destroy the memory of what came before. And memory is so important. You know, we erase memory because it's inconvenient. Huh, and the truths are inconvenient. Please say more about what you think he may have meant there about destroying the memory of what came before.
So I love this quote. Like, I talked to Roberto for probably half an hour, and I was like, oh, my God. Yes, it's true. It's an illusion that it's an illusion, right? But it's deadly, it's murderous. And he said memory destroying thing, which is a very curious, it's just very curious, right? Like, what does he mean by this? And he's actually writing a book, a memoir that will be published in the fall. So what I think he means is that, and it speaks to what we were just talking about, is like, to create a border, to create all of these things, right, that divide people, we have to destroy what came before it. And so it's easy for people to imagine that the U.S. has always had borders, right? I hear that all the time. But we've always had borders, or we've never had an open border. And people don't realize that for the first 100 years after the Declaration of Independence was signed, there were effectively open borders. And it speaks to, you know, when people ask me, what part of Mexico is your family from, without realizing that the border has moved and shifted. I was like amazed by, I would tell people, so I actually lived in New York City for 16 years, even though I'm from Texas, and I just moved back to Texas a little over a year ago. And I would tell people, you realize that Border Patrol is majority Latinx, right? I don't think people realize that. And I think there's this whole like imaginary where we think a border exists, right, on our southern border. And like on the U.S. side, there's white people and their customs, quote unquote, white people and their customs. And on the southern side, there's like, quote unquote, Mexicans and their customs. But it's the same people. So in these counties, and I've done some research on this, in these counties of Texas, there it'll be like 80 to 90% Latinx, specifically, you know, Mexican-American, because that's just the population. And so when Border Patrol is like hiring people, they target obviously people within those communities, but they'll also go to, for example, like San Antonio, and they'll target people who need jobs. And many people, just because this is what the population is Latinx. So now you have something like 51% of Border Patrol is Latinx. And so I think it, you know, even, for example, Linda Ronstadt, she spoke out recently. She grew up in Arizona, and she commented on this, and she said, you know, she remembers people would just cross all the time into Mexico for baptisms, for weddings. There's been other journalists talk about how there used to not be a wall, you know, in San Diego, and people would just come, you know, maybe they would work, and then they would cross back and go home. And so we forget these things, and we take it, we imagine that the border and these walls have been there, right? And we just like, but they haven't been. And so I think that's what he was talking about when he says it's a memory destroying thing.
I also, you reminded me of, you know, my ancestors, Eastern European Jewish background, and they wanted to become fully American. I mean, people changed their name from like Ginsburg to Gainsborough, you know, to try to sound WASPy, and wiping out the memory of that. They wanted to get away from that, but you can't do that. And it's, you know, there's people, luckily, I think these days are like re-embracing who we are, you know, our cultural identities. We kind of need that to feel like a part of something, and that we, you know, we have something there. And a lot was lost and giving up that memory, trying to wipe out that memory. It doesn't work for long. It's really not a good thing, I don't think. For those who may have just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. It's a group effort, of course. And our guest today is Rebecca Centeno. Title of her article in Truth Out is We Can't Obtain Immigration Justice in a World of Borders and Nations. We're talking about the nature of borders and keeping people out. And we're going to get to what can be done about that. I mean, but I did want to touch on, as you said, you know, when they hire a customs official, ICE and stuff like that, you go to people who are in need of work. You know, that's the way it always is. Who is profiting from border crackdowns, border enforcement, migrant detention, and surveillance? And who benefits from keeping undocumented workers' status illegal?
There are so many people that profit. Like, it's just like the drug war, right? At least with border enforcement, there have been billions that have been spent on, you know, migrant detention to surveillance. Groups like Amazon, Dell, Microsoft, they work with data mining companies who work with ICE. And so this is like really entrenched, you know, in our economic system, where people, businesses also profit off of undocumented labor. And Trump himself, as we know, has hired undocumented people. And he said, and this is an article, like, he admitted this was a common hiring practice. He said it was a way that people did business. And there's been, you know, I did research on this where, you know, and here's something that, like, that is also a fallacy, and that's in the article, that I think it speaks to this, right? It speaks to profits, but I don't think people realize is that first, one of the fallacies, right, is that first you can stop people from moving when they need to move, because they've done studies and research on this, and all of these, you know, horrible policies still don't deter people from moving. And when I met, you know, with people, as I mentioned, in Mexico City, who were coming up, many from Honduras, and they would say that they weren't afraid of what they were going to encounter at the border, because it was worse their countries where they were right. fleeing from was worse.
Yes.
And so that's one thing, right? That's a fallacy, that you could stop people from migrating when they need to move. The other fallacy is that the U.S. actually wants to completely stop people. So they don't really want to stop people. They want to control migration, and they want to weaken people once they get in. And so how do they do that? Well, they create hierarchies of immigration status.
Right.
So some people are allowed to work. Some people are allowed to study. I mean, there's people who are children who are documented, and their parents aren't documented. And so they're faced with the question right. of, like, if I, do I move my whole family? I mean, there's just all kinds of ways that that we rank people, and it benefits the ruling class. And so, in doing research about this, about who profits, mm-hmm. I came across an article that said a cutoff, like a complete cutoff of undocumented labor, would cause a recession. And the economy to contract. And Sharma said, like, entire sectors of the economy would effectively cease to exist were it not for undocumented immigrants. And so people are very much profiting off of all of this misery, which is disturbing.
Well, this is an ongoing race to the bottom. It's been going on for years and years and years. Maximize profits and pay people as little as you can. And, of course, that fits in nicely with this whole illegal immigrant thing. And there are people who, don't get this. They want to keep people out. They think, it helps us, the white, lower class people, working class people feel, well, I may not be much, but at least I'm, white as compared to these other people. And it's this, it's as you quote James Baldwin, who says, the great author, whiteness is a sociopolitical construct, an American lie that was created because, in his words, of the necessity of denying the black presence and justifying the black subjugation, end of quote. And, the immigrants are good for the economy. That, the white people say, oh, they're, they're living off welfare and stuff like that, and they're taking our jobs. It is absolutely not accurate. They contribute much more than they take. And, ideally, I was taught back in the 50s, yes, I'm that old, that ideally America is a mosaic, e pluribus unum, out of many, one. And the racist right is resisting that more than I would have ever imagined. And they insist that whiteness deserves to be a ruling class. Can it be done? I mean, we welcome, there are people who bravely put up signs, we welcome refugees, and we do. It makes us, it adds to the color of the mosaic. I mean, wouldn't it be boring just to eat British food all the time? Yuck. I can't believe they had an empire with such lousy cuisine. But, the Mexican food, it adds color to us. It adds to the mosaic. Are people, what's a way to deal with that? Are people understanding the issue? I'm thinking the harshness of Trump's policies, I think, is waking people up to this. And as you say, and this may be kind of stretching it here, transcending borders and nation states is a revolutionary project. Well, people aren't necessarily comfortable being revolutionaries. What is this vision, and how do you think you see it starting to move ahead, and maybe ways that it could move ahead? There's a lot there.
Yeah, there's a lot. When you were talking about whiteness and refugees and inclusion, I just thought of this meme I saw that's so simple, but yet so clearly stated, and it says, okay, you don't want refugees, stop creating them.
Exactly, yes. That's
And here's something that I'm aware of time, but I did want to mention, this is not in the article, but because I was restricted on the amount of words and everything, and I was just like, oh my God, this is going to open like a whole other thing, but like
oh, please
a
do.
Real curveball in this that we haven't talked about yet is climate change. And like, people are going to have to be moving from areas potentially that are not habitable anymore, even within, not just like people moving from one nation to another nation, even like states. Look at what's happening in California. And Nandita talked about this when I interviewed her, is like, climate refugee, and there's articles about this, climate refugee is not a protected status under the UN.
Oh my.
So there's a potential that, because I said to Nandita, I'm like, this is not sustainable. You know, the system that we have of like borders and nations is not sustainable. And she said, it is, it can get worse. The question is it just? And right, climate change throws a real curveball, and we should really be thinking about this as it relates to borders and nations and migration. It's funny, the part about this is a revolutionary project. So I was texting with a friend of mine, and he's like, yeah, but how do you do this? Like, besides, like, you know, revolution. And I'm like, no, I'm saying revolution. And so I'm not talking, you know, what I think it takes a lot of things. I think it takes, like, real clear shifts of consciousness, political education, massive mobilizations, also cross-national solidarity.
Mm-hmm.
So in this digital age, which is amazing, we can talk to people, you know, in Mexico, we can talk to people in Iran, we can talk to people all over the country, which is like something that didn't exist even, you know, I'm closer to 40. And a lot of this technology, like even live streaming, you know, uprisings didn't exist. That was like fairly new, 2010 to 2011, like with Occupy Wall Street.
Right.
So I think, you know, technology can help us, I do think. But it is a revolutionary project. And I think at one point, somewhere deep in the future, people are going to look back at this time and think like, oh my God, how did they live like that? Right? Like, how did they live like that with borders and walls? And I hope.
Yeah, it's so ugly and so unnecessary. And I think you're right. The internet, it is kind of revolutionary, really. And having it out of control, and people can talk to one another and not go through official channels. It's a unique tool that maybe can be used to bring people together and to stop these arbitrary, artificial divisions that happen. Well, if people want to read more of your stuff, Truth Out, I guess, any other things you can point them to or places they can look if they want to look more at this, what we can do about the border stuff?
Sure. I would say I have a Vimeo page.
Okay.
I would also say check out Nandita Sharma, because really, like, oh my God, she's just a huge advocate for no borders, and she's written a lot about it. Also Roberto Lovato, who's covered Central American immigrants' rights issues for many years. I would encourage people to go to both of their, you know, to look them up.
Oh, you're too humble. Well, thank you so much for being with us. This is very, very interesting and dare I say, kind of hopeful. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. This is great.
Let no one build walls to divide us. Walls of hatred, nor walls of stone. Come greet the dawn and stand beside us. We'll live together or we'll die alone. In our world, poisoned by exploitation, no sooner taken, they must give.